turned to the hallway of the building, scanning the narrow corridor. When I rushed to the parking lot outside, I found his car parked in its usual spot, where it had been since I'd confiscated the keys months earlier. He'd retired from Stanford nearly 10 years earlier, but he lived only a few blocks from campus and would often stroll the grounds on his morning walk. It was getting dark, nearing 8 o'clock, and it had started to rain. I quickly made the walk to campus. I found him sitting on the front steps of the building of his former office. His short-sleeved polo shirt was drenched through, and he wore slippers on his feet. When I went to him, pulling gently on his arm, he looked at me with a blank expression for several minutes before his face took on any sort of recognition. I guided him home, holding his hand as if he were a small child. I made dinner, turned the television on for him, and called Francie. "Mark's found a nursing home in Belmont for Dad," she told me that night. "It specializes in Alzheimer's. We put him on the wait list a few months ago, but it's perfect timing. They have a bed that just opened."
"You mean someone just died?" I said.
"What?"
"When a bed opens up in a nursing home, it means someone just died."
Francie didn't say anything. "I'm just saying." I shrugged, though she couldn't see the gesture.
"Okay," I relented. "Belmont's pretty close to Palo Alto, so it won't be too hard to move him."
In the other room, the music of Jeopardy was playing, and now and then my father would mumble an answer.
"Not Belmont, California."
I felt the tension in her voice.
"Belmont, Massachusetts."
"Fuck you, Francie," I thought to myself, but managed not to speak the words aloud.
"It's very close to us. We could visit a few times a week."
"I can visit him a few times a week," I pointed out.
"I meant me and Mark, and the girls."
"Are you kidding me, Francie? Why not a place out here?" I asked. "Wouldn't that make a hell of a lot more sense? Rather than uprooting him and moving him all the way across the country? It's gonna be a big enough adjustment for him as it is."
"I hardly see how it matters," Francie said. "He can barely keep track of where he is now. It's only going to get worse."
"Francie, why on earth would you want to move him all the way out there?" I asked.
"I'd like to be able to see him more often," she said in a small voice.
For a moment, I entertained the idea, but then she kept talking.
"And Mark and I are going to be the ones paying for it."
"If that's what this is about, I'll figure out a way to pay half."
"You don't need to. That's not what I'm saying. I think we should get some say in this."
But I wasn't going to back down that easily. Francie might have been paying for the nursing home, but our father wasn't a fancy car or an expensive toy.
1873, he yelled from the other room. "Charlotte, come in here. It's nearly time for Final Jeopardy."
"I'll be there in a minute, Dad," I called back.
"No," I said into the phone. "What do you mean, no?"
"I mean, no. We are not moving him out there. I refuse. He's lived nearly his whole life in California. This is his home."
"You're being melodramatic. He can't even remember where his home is."
"Don't call me melodramatic," I said through clenched teeth. "You chose to leave here. He did not. I'm not moving him."
We were silent for a long minute on the line as Francie weighed my words.
"Fine," she said. "Look into nursing homes out there. We'll see if we can find something else." And so our father moved into the Pine Ridge home in Palo Alto. He'd been there for over a year when I became pregnant with Mia. By then, his memory was truly failing. Each time I went to see him, my belly bigger than the week before, I'd have to remind him I was having a baby. I knew that Francie called him each week, and I secretly hoped our father would mention my pregnancy to her, but he never did.
or if he did, not in a way that made any sense to her. Francie. The Pine Ridge home was a nice facility as far as nursing homes went. There were manicured green lawns with paved paths you could push a wheelchair down. There was a garden of bright flowers and an aviary that overlooked the grounds. The nurses were competent and relatively cheerful, and the rooms looked more like bedrooms than hospital rooms. But as we made our way toward our father's room, the hallway still carried the sour smells of urine, cafeteria food, and disinfectant. Many of the patients appeared nearly comatose, lying immobile in beds as they stared vacantly at television screens or sleeping away most of the afternoon. I walked slowly, wanting to delay the arrival at our father's room. We'd gone during my last visit in April, and I'd brought the girls. The place had visibly scared them, and they'd cowered in the corner with a coloring book while my father tried to figure out who we all were. It was the part of every visit that I dreaded, and I hated myself for it. When we arrived, I stood anxiously by the door with Mia, but Lottie hobbled inside. "Hi, Dad," she said, and I followed her. Our father lay on top of the covers, fully dressed with his shoes on. He read a medical magazine, holding the page close to his face, despite the fact that he was wearing his glasses. When we came into the room, it took him a moment to tear his eyes from the page. He looked older than when I'd last seen him, but it wasn't the aging that was jarring to see. It was the absence of expression on his face. "Hello," he said, eyes moving from Lottie to me to Mia and then back to Lottie again. "Hello," he repeated. "Dad, it's Charlotte and Francie, and your granddaughter Mia." Lottie took a seat on the edge of his bed. "Hello? Hello?" He didn't comment on Lottie's injuries. "Hi, Dad," I said, stepping forward. I leaned in and gave him a kiss on the cheek, his untrimmed beard prickly against my lips. He grasped my hand, and I was surprised by how tight his grip was. "Catherine," he said. Catherine was our mother. "No, Dad, I'm Francie." I blinked back tears, having forgotten how difficult it always was to see him, each time worse than the last. "Catherine?" His brows were drawn together in a look of permanent confusion. "Francie," I said, trying to smile at him. He released my hand and leaned back on the pillow, his interest in me gone as quickly as it had come. "Francie, why don't you and Dad take a walk outside?" Lottie suggested. "Me and I will wait here." "Oh, I don't know." I hated that my own father filled me with such discomfort, but I wasn't used to seeing him like this. Though I called every week, my phone calls were short and perfunctory, obligations that lasted less than 5 minutes and consisted of me talking without stopping until I finally signed off. On more than one occasion, one of the nurses got on to inform me that he was ready to rest, and I'd wondered how long I'd been talking to an empty phone line. "Go on," Lottie urged. "He likes to be in the sun." "Okay. Come on, Dad." I settled Mia on the edge of the bed with Lottie and then helped my father up. We found his coat hanging on the door, and once he was wearing it, he was surprisingly able, not needing me for support, able to walk easily on his own. Despite his failing mind, he was only 70. Outside, the sun was bright and the air crisp. We walked along the stony path, past a man-made lake, and then paused to rest on a bench. My father had barely spoken since we'd come outside, but he turned to me now.
"Today is March 18th," he said solemnly. March 18th was the anniversary of Mother's death, a day that had been marked with silence during the last year that Lottie and I lived at home. Today's date was actually February 12th, but I didn't correct him.
"You left me so early, Kath."
He shook his head, his wrinkled brow folding into creases.
"You should have talked to me. You should have told me how unhappy you were."
I felt a ripple go through me, as if I'd stumbled into my parents' bedroom in the middle of some intimate act. "Dad," I said, but he waved his hand, commanding me to be quiet.
"The girls never got over it," he continued. "You should have talked to me. Maybe I could have helped."
"Daddy," I interrupted, tugging gently on his arm. I felt 6 years old. "Daddy, I'm Francie, not Mother. She's dead, remember? She died a long time ago." My throat was thick with unspent tears. He looked at me in confusion, finally seeing me, taking in the curve of my face and the shape of my mouth, comparing these features with the memory of his wife.
"Francie?" he asked.
"Yes, Daddy, Francie. You remember," I assured him.
"Your mother died," he said sadly.
"Yes, she died. But it was a long time ago." I let my hand rest on the thin cotton of his spring coat.
"I found her," he told me, leaning close as if this were some sort of secret.
Our father had gone home for lunch that afternoon. He called the school after the ambulance came to take her away.
"Yes, Daddy, I know. You found her." "I've never seen anything like that before," he whispered.
"I know, Dad. It must have been terrible."
"I don't know how she got up there."
He shook his head in bewilderment.
"What?
Up where?" I asked. "The stairs?"
"That part I never understood," he went on. "How did she get on that beam? It was so high up."
He peered at me as if I might be able to tell him. Something shivered inside me, and I felt my breath catch in my throat. Puzzle pieces rearranged themselves, shapes swimming into some sort of order, though I still couldn't see the complete picture. My heart beat so quickly that I brought my palm to my chest, trying to still it.
"And the apple on the floor," he continued. "Was she eating before? Why would she eat before doing that?"
"Apple? Dad, what are you talking about?" I asked, trying to pull him back to the present.
"Mother fell, remember?
She was carrying laundry. She fell down the stairs. Remember how steep they were?"
"The stairs," he repeated,
nodding vigorously now. The memory somehow reached.
"Yes, the stairs. They were so steep. You're right, I remember."
I nodded too, relieved to be back on familiar ground.
"We mustn't tell the girls," he said,
turning toward me again. His eyes were sad and full of emotion, the weight of Mother's memory and the millions of others glittering along the edges of his consciousness.
"I'm tired, Catherine. Let's go back now, okay?"
"Come on, Dad," I said, grateful that my voice sounded normal. I led him toward the building where Lottie waited for us. In the car on the way home, we were quiet. Mia slept in the back seat, and Lottie looked out the window.
"It must be a shock for you to see him,"
Lottie finally said, still staring out the window. I'm used to seeing him like that, but I forget how hard it must be for you. I nodded, but didn't say anything. Did he think you were mother? She asked. Yeah. I tightened my grip on the steering wheel. These days, he usually thinks I'm her, too. He thought it was March 18th, I told her. She nodded, unsurprised. Every day is March 18th. Do you remember it? I asked, and my voice was almost a whisper. I remember everything about that day. Mother had moods, too. They weren't like Lottie's, at least not that I'd ever seen, but she went through bouts when she spent long hours in her bedroom with the shades drawn. Mother's resting, would be the explanation from our father. What she needed to rest from, we were never quite sure. But during her resting periods, we were instructed not to bother her. I remember coming home from school, standing outside the bedroom with Lottie and knocking softly on the door. Mother would be dressed, lying under a throw, her arms folded neatly across her lap, a cigarette burning in the overflowing ashtray beside her. Despite our father's tireless work on cancer research, our mother was a smoker her entire life, and in most of my memories of mother, a thin cigarette burned in a nearby ashtray. A window would be partly open, and the room smelled of fog and smoke. Her bedroom would be cool, even on the hottest days. A quiet, dark sanctuary, and Lottie and I would climb onto the bed. We'd lie on opposite sides of Mother, our heads pressed against her as we told her about our day. Mother would stroke our hair and foreheads, murmuring in response, asking a question here and there. Even though she didn't appear to be sick, we knew enough to treat her as if she were, using our best manners and quietest voices. We never quarreled when we were in the bedroom, but were more united than ever, often clasping hands across the narrow frame of Mother's body. After an hour or so, it would be time to go. Okay, lambs. Mother needs her rest now, she'd say, closing her eyes. You go fix yourself something to eat. I'll be down soon. We knew she wouldn't. Rarely during her resting periods did she emerge until our father came home. He'd cook dinner and then go into the bedroom, somehow finding a way to rouse her and bring her downstairs to sit with us at the table. Mother's resting periods were not often, but they were not infrequent either. They'd usually span a few weeks, 2 or 3 times a year, often around the end of fall and again in the bleakest months of February and March. I distinctly remember lying on Mother's bed and the patter of rain on the windows as her fingers spooled around the matted strands of my hair. The rest of the year, these periods were hard to remember. Usually, our mother rose early, before we were awake, and when we'd stagger sleepily down the stairs, she'd already be in the kitchen, a cup of black coffee and a cigarette in hand, a plate of toast with strawberry jam in the center of the table. When we were young, she walked us to school, holding tightly to our hands as we crossed the streets, prattling away about which assignments we'd completed and what books we were reading. As we got older, she kissed us goodbye at the door, double-checking that we'd remembered to bring the sandwich she'd packed or a pocketful of change for lunch. In the weeks preceding her death, Mother had been in one of her resting periods. As Lottie and I got older, we no longer lay in bed with her. By then, her moods had gotten tiresome and frustrating for us, and when we got home from school, we'd usually just knock on the door and yell, "We're home!" Only rarely did we bother to go inside. On that morning, I thought she'd surfaced from her resting. When I came into the kitchen for breakfast, she was already there, leaning over a frying pan of scrambled eggs with a spatula in hand. "Morning, hun," she said brightly, as if she'd done this every morning for the past 2 weeks. I sat down at the table and tried not to look surprised by the sight of her awake and dressed at this hour. "Hi," I mumbled, reaching for a piece of toast. Whenever Mother retreated from her resting periods, I found myself acting cold and distant toward her for the first few days. Whether I was punishing her for the weeks she'd been away or protecting myself in case she retreated again, I wasn't sure. "I'm making eggs," she said, giving the eggs a final stir in the pan. "I'm not that hungry. Toast is fine." I slouched lower in the chair. "Have a little, and sit up straight." She spooned the eggs onto my plate, and I sat up, rolling my eyes and sighing dramatically. "Morning," Lottie said as she bounced into the kitchen. "You look nice today," she said to Lottie. "Thanks." She wore a yellow dress with white piping at the sleeves and brown cowboy boots. She'd picked the dress up at a thrift store, and it looked like a waitress's uniform from the 1950s. But somehow, Lottie managed to carry it. I knew my mother hated the outfit, and her comment showed how hard she was trying. She put a steaming plate before Lottie. "Yum, thanks," Lottie said, and I felt guilty for my sulkiness. We ate in silence. Mother perched on the edge of her chair, sipping her coffee and fingering an unlit cigarette. She didn't approve of smoking while people were eating, but as soon as we were done, she stacked our plates in the kitchen sink and lit up, taking a long drag off the cigarette as if she'd been waiting ages for it and not just the 5 minutes it took for us to eat the eggs. "Do you have busy days?" she asked as we gathered our bags by the front door. "I have an in-class essay in English today," Lottie said. "I have a French test." I hoisted my backpack onto both shoulders. "Well, good luck to you both. I know you'll do wonderfully." She leaned in to kiss each of us, first on the cheek and then on the mouth, as she hadn't done since we were young. Pulling away, I noticed that her eyes were moist. I felt a wave of frustration and anger at her, certain that when we returned from school that afternoon, she would have retreated to the bedroom for another several weeks. The resting was not over. "I have every confidence that you will succeed in all that you do," she said, holding my chin in her hands. "Thanks." I looked down at the ground so as not to let my disappointment show. I stared at my mother's white slippers, the furry cotton meeting her curved ankle. As we let ourselves outside, the screen door banging behind us, I was aware of Mother standing in the doorway, watching us walk down the driveway. I didn't turn back to wave goodbye, though Lottie did. "That was weird," I said softly when we'd turned down the road. "I guess she's feeling better," Lottie said, the hope rising in her voice. "No," I shook my head. "She's faking it. I can tell." We talked of other things for the rest of the walk to school, how Marty had been ignoring Lottie, and if she should try out at the upcoming audition for Pippin. I listened, offering my thoughts when asked, but I was picturing Mother's feet, how sad and forlorn they looked in the graying slippers with their wilting pink bows. It was the last image I would have of her. "Dad said something," I told Lottie now as I drove. It was the middle of the day, and the traffic on the highway was light. Lottie had put on a CD, something quiet and pretty, a haunting woman's voice melded with a guitar. "He said something about Mother." "She's all he talks about," Lottie said. "No, it wasn't just about her," I said. "He was talking about the day she died, when he found her." I swallowed the lump in my throat. "He said he didn't understand how she got on the beam, and something about an apple. Do you know what he meant?" Lottie was silent, still staring out the window, her head leaning against the pane of glass. When she didn't answer, I asked her again, this time more urgently. "What did he mean, Lottie?" Finally, she took her gaze from the withered yellow fields along the highway and turned to me. And when she did, her expression was filled with such sorrow that I had to look away. Do you really want to talk about this, Francie? We don't have to. Her voice was kind, protective, and it reminded me of when we were young. I frowned at the road. In some dark recess of my brain, I was already fairly certain where this conversation would lead. Tell me, I said. Lottie sighed. Okay, then. Pull over at the next rest stop, she ordered. We can't talk about this while we're driving. It was another 5 minutes before we came to a rest stop. Finally, we were parked off the highway by a public restroom and several picnic tables. A family of four was at the table nearest us, and I watched the mother dole out juice boxes to her husband and children. Lottie reached for my hand. What do you want to know? She asked quietly. In the rearview mirror, Mia slept soundly, her flickering eyelids a pale lavender. Mother didn't really fall down the stairs, did she? Lottie shook her head, holding me close in her gaze. Then how did she die? My throat was closing in, and tears fell from my eyes. How did she die, Lottie? I asked again. You already know, don't you? Don't make this worse than it already is. Say it, I commanded. Say it! Another moment of quiet passed before she spoke. She hung herself. Somehow, Lottie's face was placid and calm as she told me this, the words having lost their power for her over the years. But I felt something inside me crumbling. Did you know? My voice was a high-pitched whisper. Did you know all along? She nodded. I found her before Dad came home. I never told him. And I didn't want you to know. The weight of her words was like a bag of wet sand pressed into my chest. I thought of my father's words that afternoon. Not the babbling of dementia, only memory. How did she get on that beam? It was so high up. We mustn't tell the girls. Our parents' bedroom had a cathedral ceiling with wide wooden beams arching across the room. Mother was there suddenly in my mind's eye, hanging from the beam, attached with a belt or a piece of rope or a strip of sheet. Her neck hung at an unnatural angle, her tongue poking from her mouth, swollen and bright, her feet dangling above the bed, the white slippers threatening to slide off. The image rose up before me so quickly and effortlessly that it was as if it had been there all along, just waiting for me to conjure it up. I pictured our father arriving home to the scene. It was horrible to think of him standing on the bed to support her body, trying to get the homemade noose off her neck. Even while he worked, crying, sweaty, red-faced, he would have been thinking about the alternate version he'd tell his daughters and the rest of the world. There was a set of steep stairs, a load of laundry, a terrible fall. I buried my face in Lottie's shoulder and cried. Lottie. That day, March 18th, I'd gone home during lunch. The high school had an open campus policy for its students, and my friends and I would often walk to the deli on the corner for sandwiches and diet sodas. But on this day, I realized I'd left the notes for my English essay on the desk in our bedroom. I had a study hall after lunch, so I hurried home, eating the cheese and avocado sandwich Mother had packed for me that morning. As I walked the last three blocks, I wondered if she would be up or if she'd be back in bed as Francie had predicted. The front door was unlocked, and I let myself in, calling out, "Hello!" Nobody answered, but that didn't mean anything. Our father often came home during lunch, and sometimes he took Mother to one of the restaurants in town. I hurried upstairs to the bedroom I shared with Francie. Both of the beds were made, though I didn't remember making mine that morning. The tight corners and smooth lines of the blanket suggested that my mother had been in here earlier, lining up shoes and throwing dirty t-shirts into a laundry basket. I felt a flash of annoyance at her for this small invasion of privacy, as well as a quivering relief that she'd been motivated enough to clean. I found the page of notes right where I'd left them the night before, and I placed the page neatly into a folder in my backpack, pulling out an apple for the walk back to school. The door to my parents' room was closed, and I felt a sinking in my chest as I realized she was back in bed. I paused outside the room, debating whether to go in. "Mother?" I knocked lightly on the door. "I just needed to get something for school. I'm going back now." There was still no answer. I reached for the doorknob, turning it and pushing the door slowly open. Inside, it was dim, the lights off and the shades drawn. I didn't open the door all the way, just enough that I could poke my head inside. The air was thick with the familiar smell of menthol. "Mother?" I said again to the dark and silent room. I didn't see her, not completely. At first, all I noticed was a slight movement above the bed, a slow swaying, a dark shadow in the muted light, the soft gray of slippers, an overturned chair. I wasn't even certain I recognized the shape for what it was, my eyes taking on a distant, unfocused quality, not really seeing anything in front of me. The apple fell from my hand, hitting the floor with a dull thud, and I became aware that there was a strange sound filling the room, a breathy, high-pitched keening. It took me a moment to realize it was coming from me. I backed slowly out of the room, nearly falling on the landing at the top of the stairs. I left the bedroom door open, but didn't look back. Within seconds, I was running down the street back toward the school. My heart banged in my chest with a force that frightened me. By the time I was 3 blocks from school, I'd begun to walk again, my breathing coming in heavy rasps. It was not real. The farther I walked, the more certain I became. I hadn't seen anything. It was a trick of the eye, bad lighting, a strange shadow thrown by my presence in the doorway. It was not real. It was not real. I repeated this to myself so many times over those 3 blocks that by the time I entered the iron gates of the schoolyard, I was certain I'd imagined it. I would go to English class, write my essay, and return home at the end of the day where we would find Mother drinking a cup of coffee or making a casserole for dinner. Francie and I would sit at the counter, eating strawberry yogurt, talking about school before going upstairs to do homework until dinner. I could picture the afternoon so clearly, all of the mundane details unfolding, that I couldn't imagine anything else. It was not real. It was not real. I proceeded to study hall, where I miraculously managed to outline my essay. The few moments in the bedroom pushed back into some far corner of my mind, some dark crevice that I would try to never peer in again, though I'd always know that it existed. It would never leave me. I had just sat down in English class, ready to write my essay, the neat page of notes on the desk in front of me, a sharpened number 2 pencil in hand, when I heard my name over the loudspeaker calling me to Mr. Lumbeck's office. While I waited for Francie, I didn't think about it. The moment had already been sealed up and shut away. But even though I couldn't look at the memory directly, a tiny voice whispered in my ear that Francie must never know. It was my mother's voice, and she spoke to me across a deep abyss.
"Don't tell Francie," she whispered. "She's not strong enough. It is your job to protect her."
Maybe it wasn't Mother's voice after all. Maybe it was my own desire to protect Francie from the truth. Our whole lives, all I ever wanted was to protect her. Since we were placed in the same incubator, two underdeveloped babies breathing as one. When our father came to tell us Mother fell, I didn't contradict him. I didn't say a word, only nodded numbly beside Francie. I'd seen nothing. Nothing at all. Our mother had fallen down the stairs with a basket of laundry and broke her neck. It was a terrible accident, a freak accident, and I would never disagree. I had not seen a thing. Francie. "Did she have what you have?" I asked when I was empty of tears. I had often thought about my mother's resting periods, comparing them to Lottie's. I remembered the hush that descended over the house during those times, yet when she was better, the darkness of those days seemed so far away, it was hard to remember them. When she was well, it was easy to believe it would never happen again. Our mother held her sadness close, never letting us see its ugliness, as I had seen Lottie's. While I understood their pain was similar, I hadn't realized how deep my mother's was, how all-consuming it must have been for her to leave us behind. "I don't know." "I don't think so," Lottie answered. "I never saw her manic. I think hers was clinical depression without the mania." The family at the picnic table was packing up, the mother gathering wrappers and throwing everything in the trash bin. I clutched the leather of the steering wheel tightly in my fists, enjoying the ache in my knuckles. "We should have helped her," I said. "Dad should have gotten her help, or we should have. But nobody did anything. We just let her hole up in her bedroom for weeks at a time. How could we do that?" I was nearly shouting, and Mia stirred in the back seat. "Why didn't anyone do anything?" I asked more quietly. Lottie let a moment pass before she spoke, but when she did, I could tell that she'd thought about the question for a long time herself, for years before I actually asked it out loud. "It was a different time, Francie. We were just kids. We didn't know what was going on. Mother resting was normal. We didn't even know to question it." Lottie ran her thumb along the plaster of her cast, a new habit she'd acquired in the past few days. "Medication wasn't nearly as common as it is now. And you know Mother," she said with a shake of her head. "I don't think she would have agreed to therapy. And Dad," she gave a sad smile, "he didn't know how to deal with it. And he's blamed himself since she died. Then when I started having problems," Lottie trailed off and sighed. "It was too much. So I've always kept it from him." "But it's different. She had children to care for. How could she have been so selfish?" I asked bitterly. "I understand why you're so angry with her, Francie. I was too for a long time," Lottie said patiently. "You can't understand if you've never suffered through it. And then I found myself there, not wanting to live." She shook her head. "It's not something you come out of through willpower or love. It takes all that away. It's stronger than anything you can imagine." I saw the pain in her eyes as she spoke. I unclenched my hands from the wheel and flexed my fingers. "Have you thought about it?" I asked, not sure if I really wanted to hear the answer. "Many times." She let her head rest on her window. "Many, many times. We were silent, both of us staring straight ahead at the squat brick building of the restroom. I once heard a program on the radio about suicide being contagious, Lottie said after several minutes. I turned to look at her. Though she wasn't crying, her skin had gone blotchy with emotion, her eyes rimmed pink. I knew if I were to look at my own reflection in the mirror, I would see the same pink and white complexion, the same bloodshot eyes. Mirror images. What do you mean, contagious? Lottie wouldn't look at me, but she kept talking. Not contagious like the flu, but in the sense that once you know someone who's committed suicide, you may be more likely to do it yourself.
That's horrible. Why?
Lottie rubbed the cast with her thumb again. It's like opening a door. The idea of suicide is so taboo, so awful. But when you've been exposed to it, it loses some of that forbidden quality. It's more likely to feel like an option. She took a deep breath and met my eyes. At least, that's according to the program I heard. It could be a load of bull, for all I know, she said, trying to take the weight out of what she had just said.
Is it for you? I asked.
Is what for me?
Is it an option?
Lottie turned to look at me, holding my gaze steady in hers. You want me to say no? You want me to tell you that I could never do what she did? That I hate her for it? That I would never do that to Mia? And I really want to tell you that, because I want it to be true. She looked away, unable to face me as she continued. But you're my twin, Francie. My other half. And you would know that I was lying. She closed her eyes and leaned back in her seat. I watched her, my heart filled with so many emotions, past and present, anger and love and pity and fear and a deep, deep sadness that had always been there but was sharper and clearer now, too. Lottie didn't open her eyes or shift in her seat. Can we go home now, please? She said finally in a small voice. Can we please just go home? I started up the car and squeezed the wheel, trying to calm myself. I shifted the car into drive and we headed back. Lottie didn't speak, and I didn't ask any more questions. As I drove, trying to pay attention to the traffic and road ahead of me, my mind was 1,000 miles away. The magnitude of what Lottie had seen was slowly sinking in. I imagined the trauma of that day in our parents' bedroom. I could imagine, but it wasn't real. What Lottie had seen was burned into her memory, the last image she'd have of our mother. I shifted lanes, catching a glimpse of Lottie in the passenger seat, slumped and silent, possibly sleeping. I knew enough about bipolar disorder to know that a traumatic event could trigger the onset of one's first episode. Stress was another contributing factor. What kind of stress did keeping that secret cause? Had that been the start of everything? Those 6 minutes that made her older might not have been much, but they were the foundation of our whole relationship for the first 19 years of our life. Had I been weak because Lottie was strong? Was I stronger than her now, or was she still the strong one at the end of it all? I remembered what Whit had said, the terrible accusation that Lottie fell apart to please me, and his claim that I equated sickness with weakness. At the heart of it, I knew he was right, and while I would have given anything to have my sister healthy and well all of the time, a tiny, unconscious part of me
felt slightly superior every time she did fall apart. A little smug that my powerful and magnetic sister wasn't so invincible after all. Part of me was angry at her. All this time, she'd kept the truth from me, so certain that I wouldn't be able to handle it. Then I thought about how I would have responded at 16, knowing our mother took her own life, and I knew that Lottie had been right. As agonizing as my mother's death was, that pain was nothing compared to the knowledge that it was intentional. Even as an adult, I couldn't grasp it. As a child, I would have been destroyed. Lottie had shielded me not to prove that she was stronger than me. She had never felt a need to prove this. Lottie had hidden Mother's suicide only for selfless reasons, despite what it may have cost her. I reached out a hand and caught Lottie's fingers where they lay in her lap, squeezing them quickly before bringing my hand back to the steering wheel. She kept her eyes closed, but I knew she was awake by the way she stirred in her seat. "Thank you," I said softly, keeping my eyes on the road. Lottie didn't answer or open her eyes, but her lips rose in the tiniest and saddest of smiles. Lottie. When we arrived at my house, Mark was sitting on the front steps with Anna and Autumn. Behind them was a black suitcase and two smaller purple suitcases. My head had begun to pound lightly on the drive back from Palo Alto, and the headache's pressure increased at the sight of them. Francie let out a little, "Oh," and double-parked, nearly running from the car to her family. The girls' faces lit up when they saw her, and Francie dropped to her knees to embrace them. I saw the relief that filled her body when she stood up and leaned into Mark's chest. So many gifts my lucky sister had been given. Always the gentleman, Mark came to help me from the car. "Hello, Charlotte," he said formally, as he leaned down to kiss my cheek. "Hi, Mark." I accepted the hand he extended and allowed myself to be pulled gently from the car. The girls stood on the porch, Francie's arms draped over each of their shoulders. "Hi, Aunt Lottie," they said shyly. "Hi, girls." Once out of the car, I shrugged off Mark's help and stood by Mia's window. She was awake and rubbed at her eyes with a fist. "Want to come meet your new cousin?" Mark looked at the back seat in surprise, as if he'd forgotten there was going to be a baby somewhere. Anna and Autumn came to the window and pressed their cheeks to the glass, hands splayed by their faces as they peered at Mia.
"She's so cute," crooned Anna.
Though they were identical, I had always been able to tell them apart. "She's sleeping. Should we get her inside?" I turned to Francie, who stood beside Mark, leaning her weight into his. "Francie, can you help?" I asked, barely trying to keep the encroaching irritation out of my voice. Once we were inside, Francie made tea while the rest of us sat in my living room and watched Mia. I held her carefully on my knee. She had woken and was working her mouth in the way that indicated she was hungry. Each of the girls leaned in close to run their hands along Mia's soft cheeks, to stroke her hair, to feel the silkiness of her tiny ears. Mark watched them carefully. Francie came back from the kitchen with cups of tea for the grown-ups, plastic cups of apple cider for the girls, a bottle for Mia, and a small plate of ginger snaps. "Just two apiece," she told the girls as they eagerly reached for the plate. "So you guys just dropped in for a surprise visit?" I asked, not sure to whom I was directing the question.
"The girls missed Francie," Mark said. "Since she wasn't sure when she would be coming back home..."
He glanced at Francie, and something unspoken passed between them.
"We decided that we'd come to her. And the girls were so excited to meet Maya."
He pronounced it
Maya.
Mia, Francie and I both corrected at the same time.
Sorry, right, Mia.
Mark looked at me.
Don't worry, we won't be staying here. We've got a room at the Marriott. We just wanted to come here first.
We fell into an awkward quiet as the girls crunched their cookies.
So, Lottie, Mark said after a moment, how are you feeling?
I'm okay. A little banged up, but fine. I smiled tightly at him. I wondered if Francie would tell him about whatever had happened with Wit.
You seem to be getting around okay, he said.
I'm managing. Francie's been a huge help. I don't know what we would have done without her. I pulled Mia to my chest, resting my chin against her warm scalp.
She's beautiful, he said,
his voice softer now.
She looks just like you and Francie.
Can I hold her, Aunt Lottie? Autumn said. Like me, Autumn was the older twin. Those extra 3.5 minutes had already given her the assertiveness that Anna hadn't yet acquired. Of course, sweetheart. You can feed her. With Francie's help, we positioned Mia in Autumn's arms and showed her how to hold the bottle. They stared at each other, Mia grasping a fistful of Autumn's long blonde hair and Autumn giggling.
You look tired, Francie said to me. You should go lie down.
I'm okay, I said.
No, really. We'll take care of Mia.
The girls are dying to play with her anyway. You might as well get a rest. Anna had come to sit with her sister, and the two of them were singing Rockabye Baby to Mia.
We won't stay long, Mark said. I rented a car for the week, and we'll check into the hotel pretty soon. These two are going to crash in the next hour.
He gestured with his head to his daughters. I clutched Mia's foot, wanting to physically have some part of her touching me, not ready to relinquish her. But the headache was a dull pain over my eyes. The room was too bright, and I longed to close my eyes against all of this. I released her foot and struggled to rise. Okay, I guess I will lie down for a few minutes. Mark got me by the elbow and helped me up. He walked me down to my room, and this time I didn't pull away. It was good of you to come. I know Francie is glad you're here, I said to Mark.
We missed her, he said.
He looked at me closely, his face gentler than I remembered it.
Charlotte, we're not here to take over. I just wanted to help Francie.
I nodded, swallowing a lump in my throat.
We'll be gone by the time you get up, he said,
stepping back into the hall. I stood in the doorway, listening to the sounds coming from the other room. Anna and Autumn's chatter, Mia's squeals and gurgles, the quiet hum of Francie and Mark's voices. They sounded like a family.
Francie. When I saw Mark sitting with the girls on Lottie's front steps, I was surprised by how much my heart lifted. I hadn't wanted him to come, had convinced him several times on the phone that he didn't need to come, but when I saw him sitting there, it was as if the world clicked into place just a little. After the afternoon's terrible revelation, I needed normal more than anything. I needed my husband and children to ground me and remind me who I was now that the floor of my childhood had collapsed. I breathed in his smell, my face fitting perfectly in the soft groove of his neck. You're here, I said to him in disbelief.
We missed you,
he said, planting a kiss on my mouth, and I thought to myself, how could I have almost forgotten how good this is?
Now, in Lottie's living room, the girls fawned over Mia, and Mark and I shared a chair. The days apart had left us affectionate and loving in a way we rarely were lately. Anna and Autumn were kneeling by the coffee table in front of Mia's infant seat. They cooed at her, sang her songs, and reached out their fingers for her to grasp. Mark and I watched them.
Thank you for coming, I said to him. How long are you here for?
Till Saturday. Are you going to come back with us?
Today was Tuesday. I adjusted in his lap, leaning back against him.
I don't know.
She seems like she's doing all right.
He gestured with his chin toward the hallway that led to Lottie's room.
She's up and walking around.
But she can hardly do anything for the baby, I said, trying not to get annoyed.
I thought you said you'd talk to her neighbor about helping out.
I did, but I don't know how available she is.
Well, is there anyone else who might be able to help? What about Whit?
I blushed unconsciously, the fever creeping into my cheeks. I'd almost let myself forget about what had happened, what had almost happened the other night. Somehow, seeing Mark, feeling such joy and relief at his appearance, I'd allowed the shame of the other evening to slip away. But it was suddenly back, pricking at my skin with its sharp needles. I fussed in the diaper bag for a wipe to clean Mia's hands so that my hair fell forward to mask the pinkness of my face. When I turned back to him, I hoped my color was a little more normal. They're not together anymore. I don't know how much he's going to be around. I don't think he can be counted on to help, I said. He was watching me closely.
Well, is there anyone else?
No, Mark, there's not, I said, unable to control the snippiness in my voice. There's just me. I stood up and moved to the couch. Mark shifted in his chair.
Well, you need to talk to Sally about her schedule and how much Charlotte normally pays her. Also, doesn't Charlotte have Mia in daycare?
Yeah, I don't know if it's every day, though. We looked at the three girls. Mia was blowing bubbles, and Anna and Autumn were giggling, each holding a pudgy hand.
We need to find out the daycare's hours. Do you know when her cast and that boot are coming off?
I shook my head.
Well, that's also important to find out.
Does she have a follow-up appointment with the doctor? I don't know, I said, feeling somehow foolish for not knowing the answers to any of these questions. I've been busy taking care of an infant and an invalid, I snapped, reaching for my tea so I didn't have to meet his eyes. It had gone lukewarm.
Well, we need to find out, Mark said, ignoring the annoyance in my tone. We need to have all of the information to be able to go from here. We need all the facts.
The facts. Mark was big on facts. I supposed in his job they were important. Facts, not feelings or emotions, were the things that decisions were based upon. Sometimes I thought about how easy it was to be a man like Mark. To him, numbers and statistics, truths and untruths, were the real stuff of life. He saw the world in clear terms, and I was often envious of this. You loved someone or you did not. If you loved them, you made sacrifices. If you did not, you were bound by no such obligations. I suspected that Mark didn't know what it was like to love someone so much that you were consumed by them. When your love for them was so powerful and red and raw that you sometimes wondered if it was closer to hate. In Mark's world, if you had the trappings of a good life, healthy children, a loving spouse, enough money, a beautiful home, then you should be happy. He understood little about a sadness that was like a festering sore, tender and open, and not a sharp, stabbing hurt, just a general ache that never fully went away. Sometimes I wondered if he wished he'd married a different sort of woman, one who could simply be happy without guilt or rage or malaise, a hardy woman who could weather the storms of life without cracking.
Okay, I said to him now. We'll get the facts.
Is there some other reason you don't want to go home?
He asked, leaning closer so that the girls couldn't hear.
There was so much to tell him. Wit, my mother,